The good, the bad, and the science. Television movies, comedians, and scientists. The good, the bad, and the science.
Welcome to The Good, the Bad, and the Science, the show that breaks down the science of television and movies with a comedian and a scientist. Today we're discussing Queen of Meth. So I'll ask about addiction, Tom Arnold, and, well, yeah, meth. Hi, everyone. I'm your host, Ethan Edinburgh, and I've got two wonderful guests joining me today. My first guest is an Emmy-winning actor, writer, and comedian who has blessed the earth by creating shows like Mr. Show and the increasingly poor decisions of Todd Margaret. He is a personal hero of mine, so I'm trying not to yell as I welcome to the show David Cross.
Hi, Ethan. Thank you for having me. And thank you for listing the two credits that are over my shoulder.
Yeah, I noticed that immediately. I need those posters now. That's awesome. I have like this weird bland wall next to me. Are you reporting from home?
Yes. I'm in Brooklyn, yeah.
Excellent. Okay, cool. Yeah, I saw you had some shows in the New York area because the tour got postponed. Is that right?
Yeah, it was a difficult decision, but ultimately the right one. But there were so many people were not understandably comfortable with going into a packed room that, you know, might not have the best ventilation or whatever. And, I realized also that I'm, you know, kind of in a bubble here in New York where it's very safe, you know, in a relative sense, and people are doing what they were asked to do, and most people are vaccinated and everybody wears masks and all that stuff. And, you know, it's just not like that in other parts of the country. And so rather than, you know, deal with all that, I just said, okay, I'll postpone this until the spring, you know, hopefully spring, knock on wood. But, yeah, it was a bummer because, I was ready to go, but I am going to keep doing the shows that I had booked in New York, because I was doing, you know, one or two a week, and you know, getting ready for the tour, and having a blast. And I'll tape the last couple shows that I had planned before I was going to go out, and, you know, maybe I'll put it out on my website or put it somewhere, you know, because a lot of it is material that I'm not going to be doing in the spring of 2022, probably. So, you know.
And I actually wanted to ask you one of them. I had so many questions written down to ask you, and I know we're not going to have time for it. We got to talk about meth, but I did want your take on
your
vaccine.
Too, but anyway, go ahead.
Oh, of course. I wanted your take on vaccine hesitancy as well, because I do have several people in my life, as I'm sure you do, as many people do, that are, you know, hesitant, and it's tough to discuss it with them. So have you encountered that? Is there a way you can, you know, guide that conversation?
I have. I've only, with, you know, not people on the periphery, but people that I'm close with, I've only had that discussion with one, and by extension, two people, because of a person and their spouse, who are now vaccinated. But it was, it was hard and tricky, because I have to, you know, you have to be diplomatic and not insulting, and it's frustrating, because I can't speak for anybody else, but for me, I don't. And let me preface this by saying I do understand the hesitancy. This isn't like I refusing to wear a mask. I get it. I do understand. I don't share those convictions or those fears. I got vaccinated as soon as I could, as did my wife. And as, you know, when my daughter turns 5 and the vaccine's available, she'll be first in line. And I don't share those feelings, but I do get them. I do understand them. And I understand, you know, I mean, our government lies to us daily and has since its inception, and did it before I was born, will continue to do it after I die. The government constantly lies. They've experimented on people. That's a fact. So I understand the hesitancy. I don't have it. And, you know, that was what I had to bring into the conversation. Ultimately, you know, we prevailed, but, cause they did get vaccinated and I think they're happy for it. And,
yeah, I was going to say nice work. It actually worked. You had a successful, convincing conversation, it sounds like.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't easy and it was long and it was, but it was also, you know, you can't, the things that like I say on stage, I couldn't and wouldn't say that and have that attitude to a person I was sitting in front of, you know, trying to convince them why the vaccine is why it's necessary.
Okay. Well, I want to get to our next guest, of course. I have one final question for you, and I promise I'll leave you alone and we can just really talk about meth, which I know everybody's dying to hear about, crystal meth. But I have to say, you know, just thanks for all the brilliant work that you've done over the years. And as I was reviewing it all and what it meant to me this morning, I wanted to ask if you had advice for young writers, because your consistency through the years is astounding to me.
Oh, well, thank you. My advice for writers and stand-ups are it's kind of the same, which is, and I know it's a bit trite, but you just have to write and you have to perform as much as possible. And in this day and age where you can put things up on, you could do Instagram Live or TikToks or any of those things, or put something, you have a YouTube channel. There's no excuse not to do it. And there have been plenty of people over the past several years who've gotten not just success, but deserved success and are writing for, you know, late night TV hosts and different satirical web zines. You know, you just put your stuff out there and just do it. And for stand-ups, you've got to get on stage and you just have to take any opportunity you can. And you will also gravitate towards, as happens in any business or creative endeavor, you'll gravitate towards like-minded people, and I guarantee you will all help each other, both creatively and then, literally helping them getting work. As one person gets work, they help others get work. And so just get out there and do it.
Love it. Okay. Well, thank you for being on the show once again. I'm super excited to speak to you and to speak to our second guest. He is a professor at the Elson S. Floyd College of Medicine. Welcome to the show, Dr. Michael McDonald.
Thanks, Ethan. Glad to be here.
I'm so happy you're here. You are also the director of PRISM, which sounds like you're the evil villain in a Marvel movie. So can you explain what PRISM is?
So that's a good question. We actually just switched to that acronym from an acronym that I just recently started remembering. So I'm pretty sure that's promoting research initiatives on substance abuse and mental health. And so our work really focuses on innovative, positive, strength-based interventions that we develop in collaboration with communities to help improve the quality of care for mental health disorders and substance use disorders.
Excellent. Okay. That sounds really beneficial. And I should also mention that you are a leader of the Center for Cannabis Policy Research and Outreach. So did you smoke a big fat doobie this morning?
No, man. No way. So yeah, I'm the head of our cannabis center here, which stems from like research on hemp and how hemp could be used in industrial applications, all the way to some of the projects that I have, which are looking at how cannabis, and especially one thing I'm sure we're going to probably talk about with methamphetamine, is potency or purity, and how in our current legal market, for those of us who are in decriminalized states for cannabis, how, yeah, the cannabis they can get a hold of right now is totally different than the cannabis that some of us were able to get on the legal market quite a time ago.
Yeah, I've definitely noticed that. We actually had an episode about Chopped 420, a new cooking with weed show, and had a cannabis expert on. And he was kind of saying the same thing, that weed has gotten a lot more potent. And I don't know how you feel about it, David. What's your weed usage or what it used to be, et cetera. But for me, it's like, I'm not a fan of this new weed. You know, when I sit down to smoke a joint, I'd rather be able to actually smoke a joint instead of like two hits of it, and then I have to take a break from everything in my life.
I used to smoke a bunch of weed, but it was not remotely comparable to what's out there now. I don't really smoke much anymore. I'm just not comfortable. I also was never, even though I smoked it a bunch, I was never good at it. Meaning, my chemicals react better to other different chemicals than weed. And even though it was once I became more known, it was more difficult because I would already get paranoid and antisocial. And then if I was out, I mean, I the idea of having a conversation or trying to have a conversation with somebody and I'm not cognizant became a nightmare, and I would just, you know, run away.
Yeah, I feel like that fairly often and then regret my decisions. Mike, is that what you guys are doing? Is that the leading priority for you, is making weed less potent?
Well, no, I don't know. I mean, that's a legislative thing, right? We just try to give policymakers the information that we can. And the tough thing in the United States is like, well, we can all go down here in Washington and buy like a product that has 70% THC in it. I can't use it in my research because it's federally illegal. And if I, as a university researcher, use it in my research, our whole university could lose all of our federal funding. We could lose all of our student loans.
Does that seem crazy to you?
Yeah. It's totally crazy. Yeah.
That seems crazy to me.
Yeah.
It's like, how do we tell you as a consumer if that's safe to use or not? Because it's not the same product. My friend always says it's like the difference between strawberry and strawberry Pop-Tarts. From the natural like plant that's out there. But we can't tell you if it's going to increase your risk of developing a psychotic disorder. We can't tell you if it's weed. We used to say to folks, cannabis, maybe it's not that addictive. The same way that crystal meth is. Now though, when you have a higher potency product, we just don't know. We don't know. We do see rates of cannabis use disorders going up and up and up. So I don't want to be like a reefer madness person, but we're stuck sort of. We just try to provide information to those researchers, to folks, to let them make the decisions about both the individuals, individuals, parents, but also the policymakers.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Hey everyone, this is Jesse David Fox, host of Good One, a podcast about jokes. I am proud to announce that I have personally won the streaming wars. And there's a new docu-special on Peacock based on our own Vulture podcast. Good One, a show about jokes, follows Mike Birbiglia as he develops new material, taking audiences through the process of transforming personal stories into stand-up. Featuring interviews with Mike's family and comedy colleagues like Seth Meyers, Hasan Minhaj, and Asko Akatsuka, Good One, a show about jokes, is streaming now only on Peacock.
The break is over. Here we go, back to the show about science.
Man, and are we getting closer on that to some sort of federal regulation? Because I agree with David, it does seem absolutely bonkers, especially from a educational standpoint or from a research standpoint, that you're not able to, do experiments or find results and data on something that we're all, half the country is using legally.
Yeah, exactly. So I think we're moving in the right direction. So it used to be I could only, as a researcher, get legal weed from one place, the University of Mississippi. They've now approved three other companies to produce legal cannabis for research, but I still have to go through this cumbersome process with the DEA, with the National Institute on Drug Abuse, to be able to get those products. And the products that we're going to get are still not the same. So we're making a good amount of progress. Almost every professional society in addiction, certainly all the trade organizations, all support what we call descheduling cannabis, or changing. It's considered a Schedule I drug. So if I want to do research on heroin, I have to get the same approvals for cannabis as I do for heroin to be able to access it as a researcher. And that's just, I mean, yeah, right. It doesn't make common sense. So there's a number of different plans that are out there. There's been a number of bills that have been put forth in the Senate and the House. And we still have yet to see, you know, a bunch of movement so that we could safely go down and legally purchase cannabis. And then, you know, with appropriate approvals, use that cannabis in our research. So I think we still have a long way to go. But we've made some steps in the last couple of years that are in the right direction.
Well, as we shoot into our meth talk, David, I wanted to get your experience with hard drugs. I know you tried crack once. Is that correct?
Yes.
And it was, first and last.
Yeah, it was fantastic. It was. There's a reason why I never did it again. I do not have an addictive personality, and I've done lots of drugs and, you know, been able to walk away. And that was one, you know, I didn't just smoke it once. I smoked like an entire night into the next morning. And we were going to get another batch. And I will never forget this as long as I live. I remember everything about it. I remember where I was and all that. And I was like, and I wanted to, but I was like, if we get buy another, you know, buy some more, then I think my life is going to permanently change for the worse. And I had a show to do that night too. And I'd also made a promise to myself that I would never not do a show because, or if I ever did not do a show because I was too fucked up, then I would have to go into rehab. I'd have to put myself in rehab. And I didn't want to do that. And I was like, if I don't leave now, my life will be altered in a very negative way. And I stopped. That's not to say that I didn't do it, you know, all night. And as I said, into the morning with people I would never spend 10 seconds with outside of that scenario. But yeah, it's an amazingly effective drug for sure.
Yeah, I mean, that segues us actually into a couple questions that I had watching this show. I mean, one is the addictive personality. I wanted to ask you about that, Mike. Like, if that's something that's just in us genetically, or if that comes about when we're introduced to these substances, how does that work?
Yeah, no, I think this show did a great job of documenting, like, every single risk factor we know about for addiction. And then the sort of process and how it takes control of your life, even when you think you're in control of it. And then the aftermath, although there was a little bit of bias, I think, on the aftermath, making it sort of minimizing some of the consequences from this, like, citywide and multi-statewide drug ring. So I think David already identified one piece of risk for addiction. So one factor we know influences. So I don't like the term addictive personality. I don't like tying any kind of a mental health problem to a person's personality or like who they are as a person. So that's a term I think we're really working hard at substance use.
What would you offer in its place?
Yeah, so I'd offer like some horrible term like that's way wordy, like a person who's at risk for developing a substance use disorder. So I'm like, that's the other thing. Psychologists, we like love, and mental health people, we love to like use destigmatizing language, and that's a big focus right now. But it doesn't fit with like the English language and how people speak. So that's what I'd throw out there. I mean, I just the term, I don't like personality. There, we have this whole category of diagnoses called personality disorders, and I've worked a lot with people who have the symptoms of those things, but I think that's weird to call it like personality disorder, like your personality's messed up. So that's just a personal thing I have. So I would say, yeah, David, you identified one, which is what we call executive functioning. So one risk factor that we have, that people have, that's either you have a genetic risk factor for this, and then it's influenced by environment too, but is called executive functioning. And that's like your ability to say, hey, whoa, no, I don't want to do that because this other thing's happening tomorrow. And so it's that marshmallow test that you probably have all heard of, you know, where they ask the kids like, hey, kids, come in. Yeah. Hey, kid, do you want one marshmallow now or you want to wait for five? So you heard, I heard a bunch of two marshmallows in your thinking when you're talking about that drug experience.
Yeah, I am that kid who waited and got five marshmallows. I'm definitely that person.
He's a multiple marshmallow man.
I will say I don't care for marshmallows and never.
Yeah, passed. Neither do I. They're gross.
No, s'mores. You guys don't care about s'mores. Yeah. If people are eating s'mores by fire, you say pass.
Yeah, my sister and sister-in-law, we have this annual thing where we go down to Atlanta, you know, now we've got a kid, we're down there a bunch, or, you know, pre-COVID at least, but they're, one of their big things is s'mores. They get a fire pit, and I'm like, nope.
Wow, like, I'm good.
Zero, none.
So I think that's one risk factor we know of. Another one is just negative affect, like how much negative emotions you're carrying around. And that includes things like stress, depression, anxiety. And so you could see in this episode of this show, you know, especially, or if you watched the episode before that, you could hear about Lori's life and the amount of trauma that she'd been through, the amount of stress she was under. So that's another big risk factor. And then the other one is, yeah, just how drawn you are to a drug. So we have in all of our brains, right, we have this reward pathway. So it's that same reward pathway that, you know, when you are falling in love, when you are or do something, you know, pat on the back, when people laugh at your show, like it's that part of your brain just gets activated. And what your description of using crack demonstrates is those drugs of misuse or drugs that you can become addicted to can hijack that pathway, and they can impact that pathway immediately. So for some people, that's just more accessible. The ways you ingest drugs, it's easier to get it faster into your brain. What we know about addiction is the faster it can get to your brain, and the bigger doses that you can absorb without having an adverse reaction, the more likely you are to develop an addiction. So a person who goes out, has a couple when they're 15, has a couple wine coolers, and throws up all day the next day, is probably not going to go on to develop an alcohol use disorder. They're less likely to, as opposed to the 15-year-old who drinks a case of beer, doesn't have a hangover, shows up to school the next morning. That person's more likely to be able to go on to develop an alcohol use disorder because they don't have that initial adverse reaction to the drug. And then the other one real quick thing I'd mention is you could see it throughout this whole series, but specifically this episode, is just lack of parental involvement and lack of supervision. And that was clearly is a huge risk factor, is if you don't have a caring adults over you and looking after you, you're going to engage in these kind of behaviors, or more likely to.
It struck me that, you know, towards the end of the episode, they're interviewing the kids, and the kids seem, you know, the kids were savvy enough to know what was going on. And they don't get into it, but those kids seem pretty, you know, solid, you know, like they did not go down that same road. And perhaps that's because, they watched every authority figure they knew just using and abusing, you know.
The other thing that's hard with this is it wasn't a journalistic piece. And so I wondered as I watched it, like how many of these are her friends who will actually talk to her, would actually agree to be in the show, and how many of those kids, you know, who had their lives together, like how many kids aren't there because they're in a lot of trouble. And I think a couple in the third episode, they actually talked about some of the kids that have gone on to develop their own addiction. They talked about like one of the kids is now in his 30s and has congestive heart failure from his chronic addiction and is not doing so great. So I wondered how much of the evidence was sort of being fairly presented there.
That's a good point. Yeah. Cause it wasn't, yeah, it wasn't, it was more sensationalistic than journalistic. Yeah.
Again, if you're just tuning in, I don't know why you'd start here, but we're talking about Queen of Meth, which is exclusively on Discovery Plus, about a lady named Lori Arnold, who, yes, is Tom Arnold's sister, and essentially ran a meth empire in the 80s. Brought to light a few things I didn't know, one of which, she was talking about the pros of meth for a little while, and made it sound pretty awesome. So, Mike, can you sell me on meth right now?
Yeah, so meth is a stimulant drug. I mean, David already talked about crack cocaine and meth are very similar They're both stimulant drugs. They both are usually smoked in a very similar way. And they also have a lot of other toxic ingredients in them that in addition to the stimulant drug specifically. So the thing that you get from meth is, yeah, you get an immediate high. You get an immediate high. You get an immediate euphoria. You can stay awake for days. You hear about people, like, sounds like this was, you were just about to go down this path, David, but like people will party for like 4 days.
I have done meth probably dozens of times. Crack was just
okay, so you should be asking David this question.
I was going to say, I didn't know this.
Yeah. Well, it's not something I advertise.
Put out there very often.
It's not on my, not at the top of my CV, but, and this is over the years. I'm not saying this is sure. Over a long, long time when I don't even remember when I first had it, but it was you know, it's very similar to crack. It wasn't as immediate and constant and then short lived as crack, but it was if you're in a bad mood, you're instantly in a good mood. If you don't, I'm going to hang in and just smoke weed and watch TV. I'm going to go out and I'm going to go to the bar. I don't even have to know anybody. I'm going to go see what's out there and live life. And, so it had that element to it.
Okay. Sounds pretty great. You heard it here. If you're just tuning in, David Cross promoting meth. Check it out.
I'm not promoting it.
Oh, okay. Sorry. It just sounded cool to me. I've never done meth. It sounded good. I don't want to just be at home all the time. Be nice to go out sometimes. So I'm sure there are huge cons as well. Did you experience these cons, David?
Not really. I mean, one negative thing would be it would allow you to, it's kind of similar to the coke in this way. It allows you to drink way more than you normally could, and will suffer from that either later that night or the next day. And you also have to, you lose a day. You lose, whatever time you're spending on that you have to count the next 24 hours to 36 hours are gone. You're going to be recovering in bed, not feeling good, feeling guilty, feeling nauseous. And at some point it becomes, what is it worth to you? And also, you know that it's terrible for you. You know that it's a just awful thing to put into your body and your brain. And you're aware of that, but that is, not to say that there was a reason I did it a number of times, because I really enjoyed it. And I if it didn't have any of those negative aspects, not now that I have a kid, but before I would take it. Yeah.
Wow. So yeah, Mike, I mean, it sounds like it like hijacks your brain in several ways. I mean, I didn't even know about the fact that it allowed you to drink a bunch more. How does that work?
Yeah. Or like drive your truck all the way across the United States, 2 days. I mean, like anything you want to get done, it's a way to get it done. Right. Like it's not, I think Dave did a great job describing the positives and negatives of it. So, I mean, the thing with meth is, and stimulants in general, like cocaine, is there's two kinds of patterns of use. There's people who use it just episodically, like as a party drug, or in a specific situation. So they might use it once or twice, like or over a few days, once a month. And then there's other people, like many of the people you saw in the show, that develop an addiction, develop a dependence, we used to call it. Or now we call it severe substance use disorder, severe type. So they develop tolerance, they develop a physiological addiction to the drug, and they need to have it. Otherwise, they feel really horrible all the time. And so I think those are the two patterns that we see with cocaine or with methamphetamine use.
And I also was reading a little bit about meth mouth. Can you describe how that happens or why that happens?
So I don't know. Yeah, I think it's because of like David was saying, the toxicity of the stuff that you're ingesting that is in meth. For people who use methamphetamine frequently, they have chronic disabling dental problems to the point of a lot of folks who need complete, you know, dental replacements. And so that's one thing. If you think about like recovery, like it's hard enough if you become addicted to meth, let's say, and you lose your house, you lose your family, you lose so much. And then you're trying to get back on track and you don't have teeth, like, right? Like, it's just another thing you got to deal with. And so that is a huge barrier to recovery for a lot of people, actually.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
The break is over. Here we go back to the show about science.
Was it a different scenario in 1985 when this was happening as far as the information we had about meth? Like, was there some confusion as to what it does back then that we know better now?
I don't know, because I was like a kid then. But I will say that scientifically, I think we knew. We know so much about cocaine and we know so much about amphetamines that I think we knew plenty about crystal meth, like from a scientific perspective. But did all the doctors around the United States know that? Probably not. And you could see it in the show. Did the regular folks know about it? No. Like it's a fun mm-hmm. party drug. Like, right? So if you're a person who lives in a small town and there's this exciting thing and everybody's using it, you think, whatever, I'll try it. And it's fun and it's exciting. And you maybe have like the experience David talked about with the negatives afterwards. But so I don't think people were as informed about it as they were about other drugs. And then the reaction from the federal government was to say, no, you know, you saw it in the show, say no to drugs, and to increase enforcement and to not offer more treatment necessarily or come up with new treatments that would help, but to focus more on the drug enforcement and the sort of unrealistic prevention, like just say no.
And my other question was about the purity you mentioned before. How does that make a difference? And I mean, my knowledge is essentially that I watched Breaking Bad, so I don't know if that's legit or accurate. So I wanted your take on that.
So I've never seen Breaking Bad. I may be the only person I know who has never seen it. Mostly because I like to keep my work at work. My wife like loves reality TV shows. She's also a psychologist and she loves all reality TV shows, but I like to just keep my work at work. And so when I come home, I don't watch any of that kind of stuff. I'm sure it's a good story. All right.
Great.
Best TV shows ever.
You go.
Yeah. Got to agree with them.
All right. Well, I'll watch it. So purity. It's terrifying. I'm not going to beat around the bush, man. Back then in the 80s, the purity of meth, and you heard it, they talked about cutting it. She talked about cutting it on purpose, partially to make more money, but also partially because, you know, it's a little less dangerous. But so the purity of methamphetamine now is in like the 90% purity. Before it was like, I'm not going to know the same number, but it was like 30% pure. And so we're in this new methamphetamine epidemic right now that's closely tied to fentanyl, which is a hugely dangerous opioid. And so fentanyl's super potent opioid, synthetic opioid, and it's being produced and distributed in the this new version of meth, which is in the purity level of like 90%. So last year, I think, I don't quote me exact numbers, but we had 70,000 people die from drug overdoses. Almost half of those are, close to half are methamphetamine specific, and half, and that's, are involved methamphetamine, sorry, involved methamphetamine, and half of the methamphetamine overdoses have no opioids involved. And so we have this opiate epidemic, starting with prescription drugs, transitioning to heroin, then to fentanyl. And now, right now, where I'm being called in and asked for help by, you know, policymakers or states or providers is really around this really potent, dangerous version of methamphetamine. So again, before, rare to die from a methamphetamine overdose, and kind of tough to do. Now, pretty dangerous stuff. The stuff that's out there is potentially really dangerous.
What is the reason that people are cutting various drugs with fentanyl? What is that? Is that cost effective, or is it? What does it do? Why did they do that?
It's a really good question. My understanding is basically that that's where the production is coming from. The production is easier. It's easier right now to produce and sell fentanyl. At first it was cutting it in to save money and to maybe deliver a more potent product to people that but maybe they were desiring. But now, yeah, it's tough to find heroin and it's easy to find fentanyl in most cities, and it's spreading into rural areas now. So I think it's a production area. Again, that's not my expertise. I'm a treatment person, but my understanding is really it's a production sort of where it's coming from kind of issue.
Wow. I mean, and what responsibility do you think the pharmaceutical companies have? Because it seems like that's a big part of this, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think initially they had a lot of responsibility. You know, every state right now, including ours, has either a settlement in progress or a case that's in court. Native tribes specifically are another example of communities that were really differentially negatively impacted by the opiate epidemic caused by the pharmaceutical companies. And there was, you know, knowledge. I still remember in school, and remember, I'm a psychologist, so like I don't prescribe drugs. So I remember in school back in like 2004, when OxyContin was coming out, and it was being marketed as this opioid that wasn't addictive because it was the half-life would spread out all day. So it was totally safe. So that's what we were told by drug companies, and you'd go to like the free lunch you'd get. So we're not allowed to get those free lunches anymore. For good reason. So but that was totally a lie. And we knew they knew it was a lie. All their research suggested it wasn't true. But at the same time, in our graduate school for psychology, we were told, hey, you know what? You want to stay away from opioids to manage pain in people who have mental health problems. You want to stay away from, there's no evidence that opioids that really work for chronic pain. They're really for acute pain and for chronic cancer pain or pain related to cancer care. And so I feel like, yeah, the drug companies are responsible, but also our provider community, we knew. Right. So I think there's shared responsibility there. And then, yeah, so we created a demand, and then the government and providers and all of us have worked hard to clamp down on those access to those opioids, those legal opioids. But then there's been a illegal market that's been, you know, sprung up to meet that demand.
Wow. Well, I hope someone was punished for some reason. My brain goes straight to like, oh, nothing happened to the people that... Oh.
Nothing yeah. Must happen.
It's white collar crime. I mean, people had to pay billions of dollars. They lost money, but I don't think, and I don't know the ins and outs of this right now, but I don't think...
No, the Sacklers cut a specific deal that where they paid a certain amount of money, but also ensured that they wouldn't face... you know, any kind of prison time.
Awesome. Great. Classic America move. Sweet. Well, listen, I thank you both. We're running short on time here, but David, I know you have these shows coming up in Brooklyn, but if there's anything else you want to tell people about, please do so.
No, I don't really have anything. I mean, there's a handful of things that'll be coming out in the who knows when, but and I don't. So, if you're in the New York area, I'm doing shows. I think they're all the ones that are left are in Brooklyn, I believe. But yeah, you can go on my website, officialdavidcross.com, that I have all the information. And I will be taping two sets at the Bell House in early November and putting a special out with that material.
Man, so cool. Can't wait for that. I'm sure no one needs to hear me say it, but if you haven't seen David and you get the opportunity, run, sprint, get tickets immediately. He's the best. You're simply the best. So I thank you for being here. You're simply the hero. Mike, anything you'd like to tell people about or promote, let people know?
No, I can't top that. Go get vaccinated. Keep, you know, we've got lots of great resources now, including treatments for methamphetamine, which is what I'm an expert in, and we're getting those out to people and they're becoming increasingly available. So if you are a person who's struggling with addiction or know somebody who is, reach out, seek help. We've got effective interventions now that we didn't have back in 1980.
Nice. Okay. That is good to know. Yeah. Everyone reach out to Mike personally, go visit him at home. He will help you out with whatever you need. Thank you for offering that up. And again, thank you both for being here. It was a great conversation. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely, man. My pleasure. Thank you. And Mike, nice to meet you.
Thanks, Ethan. Nice to meet you too.
Bye-bye. Get exclusive science shows, nature documentaries, and more real-life entertainment on Discovery Plus. Go to discoveryplus.com/goodbadscience to start your 7-day free trial. That's discoveryplus.com/goodbadscience.
good, the bad, the science of science. Credits, credits, credits. Hosted and produced by Ethan Edenberg, executive producer Brett Kushner, supervising producer Emily Feld, producer Barbie Rose, editor Michael Feld, talent booker Samantha Barella, post coordinator Jason McCarris, and research PA Ali Rubenstein.